KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for the following three positions: Station Manager, Evening News and Public Affairs Director, and Director of Underwriting. To apply to one of these positions, send a cover letter and resume to hiring@kboo.org, or bring or mail your resume with cover letter to 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer the following question: why is KBOO important? Open until filled. Interviews will begin around December 9th. No phone calls, please. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. For more information, go to kboo.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual Flash holiday show, running December 8th through 11th at the Alberta Abbey in Portland. Based on the 80s cult classic film Flash Gordon, Flash is Portland's premier rock opera parody, complete with a live rock band, Mercury Rising, formed at the School of Rock. Again, that's the third annual Flash holiday show, running December 8th through 11th at the Alberta Abbey, 126 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's now 10:02. The Oregon Cultural Trust mission is to lead Oregon in cultivating, growing, and valuing culture as an integral part of communities. KBOO is a longtime Cultural Trust partner. This means that if you make a donation to the Cultural Trust equal to your KBOO membership, your Cultural Trust donation will come back to you dollar for dollar when you claim your state cultural tax credit. Donating to the Cultural Trust is easy when you make a contribution to KBOO through the Give Guide. Go to kboo.fm and click on the yellow banner at the top of the screen. And now stay tuned for Poetry and Everything.
Good evening. Welcome to Poetry and Everything. I'm Judith Arcana, the show's host. Each month, we have guests who are Portland poets, nearby poets, pairs of poets, groups of poets, maybe even folks who are not poets, but everybody's reading and talking about poetry and everything. So as usual, I'll open with a bit of my own work, and then our guest and I will read work by other poets, and then he'll do a reading of his own work, and then we'll talk a lot. So the one I'm going to read tonight, I was feeling a deep need for comic relief. Perhaps many of you share that need. And so the poem I'm reading, this has not been published. Perhaps there'll be a great cry for it after I read it tonight for you. It's called "The Server Cannot Be Found." Safari says it cannot find the server. Firefox says it cannot find the server. Chrome, too. Really? Well, why not? Why can't you? I mean, that's your job. Is this a crowded restaurant or my office? Everything's flashing just as it should. The modem's tiny lights are blinking like they're guiding drivers on the interstate, like New Year's Eve fireworks, like a birthday cake for a programmer turning 39. Emails going out and coming in like a tide. I've clicked up the weather, train stations from Seattle to San Diego, the library list of my books on hold, maps with guidelines. But you cannot, still cannot, find the server? I bet even antique bots performing under huge stress all over the solar system did better than this. Where is R2-D2 when I need him, her, it? Fussy old C-3PO could handle this right now, right here. The voice of an aggravated poet dealing with electronic media. Okay. Now I'd like to introduce our guest for tonight, Matt Schumacher, whose new book of poetry, Ghost Town Odes, was published in October of this year by Red Bat Books. His previous collections include Spilling the Moon, The Fire Diaries, and favorite maritime drinking songs of the Miraculous Alcoholics, possibly one of the greatest titles ever. That's an editorial comment, of course. A graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Doctoral Program in English, Iowa Writers Workshop, and the University of Maine Poetry and Poetics Program, he helps edit the new fabulous journal, Phantom Drift, which is, I will plug in here, a Wordcraft of Oregon enterprise, and lives in the Kenton neighborhood of Portland. So hi, Matt.
Hi, Judith. Great to be here.
Welcome. Good to have you here. Excellent. So what did you bring that's something you didn't write to read to folks tonight?
Oh, well, I brought a poet who's been very important to me for a long time, a Hungarian poet named Ferenc Juhász, lived in Budapest, passed away in 2015, was a prime contender for the Nobel Prize back in 1976. He's known for a poem, a long poem called The Boy Changed Into a Stag Cries Out at the Gate of Secrets. But I'm bringing a lesser-known poem of his called Birth of the Foal. As May was opening the rosebuds, elder and lilac beginning to bloom, it was time for the mare to foal. She'd rest herself or hobble lazily after the boy who sang as he led her to pasture, wading through the meadow flowers. They wandered back at dusk, bone-tired, the moon perched on a blue shoulder of sky. Then the mare lay down, sweating and trembling, on her straw in the stable. The drowsy, heavy-bellied cows surrounding her, waiting, watching, snuffing. Later, when even the hay slept, and the shaft of the plow pointed south, the foal was born. Hours the mare spent licking the foal with its clue-blind eyes. And the foal slept at her side, a heap of feathers ripped from a bed. Straw never spread as soft as this. Milk or snow never slept like a foal. Dawn bounced up in a bright red hat, waved at the world and skipped away. Up staggered the foal. Its hooves were jelly, knots of foam. Then Day sniffed with its blue nose through the open stable window and found them, the foal nuzzling its mother, velvet fumbling for her milk. Then all the trees were talking at once. Chickens scrabbled in the yard like golden flowers. Envy withered the last stars.
Thank you. Thank you. Heavy on the fabulous images there. Whoa.
Yeah, I love his poetry.
Yeah,
he's
what
been
look.
Very important to me for a long time.
And do you look for a particular translator or just whatever you can find? Or
yeah, you know, with him, the versions seem to differ with the translators.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I've seen ones that I prefer. This one was not the one. I have a book of his at home and went to find this elsewhere because I preferred the version. So
yeah, that's why I asked. I had that experience many years ago reading Primo Levi, and I found, with the advice of my partner, that there's one particular translator who is fabulous, and then a couple others who are okay.
Yeah.
Not that I'm fluent in Italian, but you can tell.
Oh, yes.
Just like what you were saying. You can tell
absolutely
when you're getting the real deal. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, thank you. Well, folks, you're listening to our show on Monday after a long holiday weekend, the annual celebration of gratitude, which has surely been helpful to your spirit in this time. So you probably thought about how grateful most of us are to the folks who are holding the line at Standing Rock, illuminating this holiday's history. Thinking about them, I'm going to read a poem called In Memory of Crossing the Columbia by Elizabeth Woody, who is Oregon's poet laureate as we speak, whose work, both as a poet and a social justice activist, is often focused on the lives and histories of the Native nations of North America. So here's Liz Woody's poem, In Memory of Crossing the Columbia, for Charlotte Edwards Pitt and Charlotte Agnes Pitt. My board and blanket were Navajo, but my bed is inside the river. In the beads of remembrance, I am her body in my father's hands. She gave me her eyes and the warmth of basalt, the vertebrae of her back, my breastplate, the sturdy belly of mountainside. Patu, he whispered in her language. She is the mountain of change. She is the mountain of women who have lain as volcanoes before men. Red, as the woman much loved, she twisted like silvery Chinook beyond his reach. Dancing the woman salmon dance, there is not much time to waste. Liz Woody, our poet laureate. So, this is KBOO Portland, your community radio station. This is Poetry and Everything. Tonight's guest is Matt Schumacher, and now it's time for the Matt Schumacher Show on our show. He's going to give us a reading, folks, so listen up.
Great. Well, thanks, listeners. I'm going to read, eight to ten poems, I guess. I think that's about right.
Take your time.
I'll start off with something from my first book called Spilling the Moon. Had a lot of odd jobs when I was a teenager and through college, and I think the strangest job I ever had was a security guard in a toothbrush factory infested with bats. We had to go out with a fishing net and catch bats. That's not in the poem, but...
That is definitely not your typical part-time job, full-time job, or any kind of job.
Yeah. So the poem's called Excerpts from a Surrealistic Resume. Suspended by the 8-to-5 slugfest, my job as human pinata in a baseball bat factory entailed, I endured a strange, painful living. The precise disguises I devised as impersonator of the most ordinary people were never lucrative, however loudly I ballyhooed. I swore one more morning as a door-to-door worm farm salesman would land me 6 feet under, serving as their food. But later I returned to work with nature as a grizzly bear sperm collector. As crepuscular shadow chaser, I invented paraphernalia like the sunset net and daylight derailer. I distilled ambergris from the moon. I miss my stint as weeping therapist, my alluring yet ephemeral tenure, as paratrooper deducing he hasn't a chute. My bold career spearheading blindfolded brain surgery, the glint of my knife guided only by luck. A true high-octane brand of danger fuels my flames of yearning to buckle up as arsonist driving a gas truck. But life is a smirking mesmerist I liked best, hypnotizing crowds into milking cows which didn't exist. It was serene to see people's dream lives as they foliated, each dream an unfurling leaf, reflected in the lakes of their faces. My second book, Spilling the Moon, was sort of a greatest hits book for me, as a lot of people's first books are. My second book took on the theme of fire, and a group of spirits sort of take the book over towards its close, called The Fire Spirits, and this is one of those poems. It's called The Fire Spirits and the Art of Starting Fires. The bigger the fire gets, the better for the fire spirits. They make you break into a sweat, left to your imagination after you forget to turn off the gas. They're what a lit match might wish to do. They trigger your fire alarm as a reminder that everything, including you, could turn to ash. They hide mushroom cloud ideas in your house. They live past lives inside disused chimneys. The fire spirit stepped inside you when your sister let her lawn grow 3 feet tall. The summer evening you and your nephew used gasoline to burn it all. You both stood there, still brilliant-eyed at nearly midnight, laughing with the reds as they blended with yellows. Breathing the night. You felt euphoric, as if you'd lit 1,000 fuses and set the black affairs of the very evening afire. And you both leaned forward, listening, as the orange tongues said something from afar, something old as the stars, speaking to the dark. So that book's about conflagration and... My sister told me once, she said, hey, I think you've got the four elements down. So I went liquid with the next project, and Judith mentioned the title. favorite maritime drinking songs of the Miraculous Alcoholics. Right now there's a chapbook, but there is a full length, which is not yet published. But I'll read a couple of these. This one's called They Drink Spring's Return. I would say about these poems that they're, you know, I tried to rhyme way too often. I tried to be, you know, very alliterative too. So there's a lot of sound in these poems. They Drink Spring's Return. The force that through the green fuse drives the flower. Of course, that's Dylan Thomas is the epigraph. They swirl winter's shattered last gasps, swallow rhododendron and magnolia from spring's single shockingly sunlit shot glass. As the lord of the wild beasts pours them the forest, they match each fresh bud with rushing suds and reel green as seedlings. They fix the mixed drink equivalent of a swallowtail butterfly blowing up its wings and suck from a straw sleek as the bee hummingbird's beak. They sip April streams and May's deepening creeks, nourish their blood with flash floods, endure the worst storms of March with mere cocktail umbrellas. They drink the glint of the blue giant hyacinth, snowdrop and striped crocus, avalanche lily, consuming cloudless azure skies effused with bluebird plumage, relaxed as fixtures at the source of elixirs, which would rightly fill the hugest red tulips, where spring to serve its wild-flowered meadows as liquid. They pour forth its gushing rush of life force, pitcher after pitcher. So a friend of mine said that these poems are, they sound like a mouth of fizz. So I'm hoping it's a good thing to shoot for, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the Miraculous Alcoholics doing all these things. And this is another poem. It's not in the chapbook, but... And it's in the full length. It's called With a Hellish Splash. The Miraculous Alcoholics, liquid exorcists, armed with 40 raining days and nights of Noah's Ark, flood Hades with water slides. Hell yes, they do. Until the stark, fiery thereafter transforms into Adventure Water Park. Drooping souls do super loops through rivers of woe. Tantalus tantalizes us so as he glides by on flumed and chuted ride, waving with champagne glass in hand. Karen merely rose, formerly tormented souls, to frivolity. The dead take a deep breath and cannonball into Lethe. Hades must admit, the melting ski resort theme at hell's furthest outskirts is a slick, flames-licking touch. The Miraculous Alcoholics can't help slipping down, dripping mountainsides just for fun, and very much like to pretend they're drunken ski instructors slaloming uncontrollably through hell. Weary, they stay deeply asleep, trapped in avalanche, tucked away in fake snowbound chateau, lost household, which continually slides downhill. Yeah, I hope that they're a lot of fun, those poems. So.
Ski resorts. Wonderful.
I am going to move to the brand new book.
All right.
Ghost Town Odes, which is the most historical book I've ever written. When I started off wanting to write this, I thought of a series of poems named after ghost towns, and perhaps, you know, I could unfold some of the history of each town, and it gradually grew into, well, I need more variety than that in the titles, and sometimes, you know, the poetry sort of had an effect a little bit on the history, and there's sort of a force, a push and a pull between the fact and the poem, obviously, so it's an interesting kind of poem to try to write, but it winds up being, well, I don't know, I think this book is 150 pages, so it's about double what your usual poetry book is, so the effort's certainly there. This is a poem early in the book, lots of poems about Oregon places. This is one called Crater Lake Ode. You'll never view blue this unearthly unless you peruse its depths in person. Such blue mystifies the eye, from rhapsodizing iris to stupefied pupil, immerses tourist in glowing oceanographer. No one can map the place Crater Lake's blue takes you. Shades this deep must be trapped for centuries inside collapse, and shadows cast by blown volcano dome, and slowly released each season through melting ice and blizzards that encastle Wizard Island's pine spires, as if with open eye the earth were dreaming. Hmm. I lived in a cabin out by Mount Hood for about 3 years. Chopped my own wood and among other things. This is a poem from the cabin time. First snow in the Mount Hood National Forest. The power's out in Rhododendron, Oregon again. The cabin dim. Overnight, a soft white decides to quietly drape the junipers and pines until some trees seem completely composed of snow. Drowsily, our eyes find the edges of the blinding world. The sun seems to be melting a world of tall white trees, light suddenly liquid. Every drop in this dripping forest sparkles. I have a section in the book. It's the third section, and I do take on some voices from the ghost towns. This is one of those voice poems. There's a character from Oregon history named F. Wallace White. He was one of the first major mail fraud swindlers. Ran a farcical gold mine out in Bourne, Oregon, which if you ever go to Sumter, Bourne is a little haunted little area down a gravel road. You'll see a sign nearby, and you should
literally a ghost town.
Yeah, it is. There's still people out there living and trying to mine it, but there are lots of tailings, of course, and even his crumbling remains of his mansion are out there. So it's a fascinating story. And I wrote this in his voice, and it's called F. Wallace White Recites His Swindler Soliloquy, Bourne, Oregon. Epigraph is, Bourne has been called an open-air closet of skeletons. Ben Mulleton. Stunning, isn't it, how presumptuously the average man takes advantage whenever he can, how wind invites itself right in and bears down on a narrow canyon. Miners who struck gold at Cracker Creek renamed their camp in 1895 to venerate the owner of the nearby Excelsior mine, Senator Jonathan Bourne, son that Harvard bluebuds buried in D.C. and never lived a day in eastern Oregon. I was more brash than Bourne's mustache and black and white photos of the time, and many-fold as bold, as industriously sworn to injustice as dear Jonathan was bound to uphold the law, daring like the dark handlebars bristling to overtake his face and jaw. My swindles overpowered the hour when my time came, and I was unafraid to wash away the town's good name. My name is F. Wallace White, and I moved in, an opportunistic parasite, spreading, multiplying lies like disease, publishing my spurious, embellished version of the news, boldly printing overestimates of the overflowing gold, the fake profits of the slowing North Pole mine. My schemes fleeced many an investor out east and overseas. My genius was the ease. The postmaster sorted out my fortune. I didn't pan or dig an inch. I didn't flinch but sank my pickaxe fast into these stupid dupes. I paid thugs to brandish shotguns outside our mines to assure buyers dreamed of richer ore. Who'd miss the fun of spilling all their full New York and London lucre? Certainly not I. I built a rustic mansion on the hill with a rose and white quartz fireplace to rival any luxury. Its grand staircases arose from my mail fraud proceeds. I may have lied, but you all need to rake these tailings. Wind, water, human frailty, and failing kill. They're the scoundrels who erode. I am gold. I breathe the good life into these backwoods, a shrewd tycoon who cleared out years ago. And your beloved senator has died. Bourne, Oregon, you ruined boarding house. Goodbye.
How did you first hear about that guy? How did you learn of him?
Oh, I was you know, I became interested in the ghost town, and I kept doing reading, and I believe there's an Oregon sort of weird news site online, and I picked up on it there. And I actually, for the book, I spent a lot of time at the OHS library and going through newspaper clippings, and so actually a great deal of fun to learn
about
all this stuff. So
thank you.
Yeah, it's a, everyone should go there. It's a interesting place. Haunted, I think.
Certainly sounds like it in your poem.
Do you have time for one more?
Oh, absolutely.
Great. I'm going to read a poem for my cat, actually, about my cat. And there are some animal poems in here. We have some rescues at our house. We have a tortoise and a pig. And so there are poems representing those creatures in here.
Reasonably enough. Yeah.
This one's about my little tortoiseshell cat. Poem's called Reverie. Sometimes eons recede in the gaze of my green-eyed tortoiseshell cat, and a nubile lineage claws its way into the present. Wintering lynx paw the snow, and huntresses nestle tall grass in the Serengeti. Because her stare is an ancestry stretching back to the saber tooth, a ruthlessly beautiful dream the earth is having about the speeding cheetah, the mountain lion leaping from the pine tree. I move slowly or not at all. Nothing should disturb such a dream. The sunlight turns her eyes to gold, so precise that God should use it for a blowtorch to spread veins through the living. It could be I am about to see exactly what led Egypt to worship the cat as a deity. I may be about to find out why myth attributes to her so many omens, so many lives, why the world of her fur arrayed in shades of red, black, gray, and tan lands adeptly after a leap over the fence. Her tongue, red, delicate rivulet, caresses little fangs, keeping all these secrets. Great creatures.
Yeah. And the thing about Egypt, I mean, the whole notion, particularly in our time and in this place, of worshiping the cat or making deities of cats is so striking because it's so alien to our current situation and place, and yet a kind of radiant light out of history, which you've captured in the cat's eyes in the poem.
She always said that, you know, when we found her, she had a stare down with us, and she would not let us leave without her. It was kind of an odd situation. My wife and I were like, we looked at each other and we're like, we have to take her home, you know. So she willed us into taking her home with that stare that I talked about in the poem. So pretty amazing.
Okay, so you're going to close with that, or you've got another one?
Should I do one more?
Absolutely.
Okay, I have, let's see, let me do one of the ghost town odes. That's the second section. Don't know if you know the area, but Cornucopia.
No, I don't.
There are lots of notes in the back of the book. I'll read you a quick note about
Cornucopia.
This poem was composed in honor of the ghost town of Cornucopia, some of which still stands beside the Cornucopia Mines operation in the Wallowa Mountains of northeastern Oregon. Snows of 15 feet or more were commonplace. Cornucopia Mines was the sixth largest mining operation in the United States and the longest running mining operation in Oregon.
Really?
It's a pretty amazing place. This is in honor of the snowstorms. Snowstorms of Cornucopia is the name of the poem. I bet they kept winter a secret, or so one might suppose from the proportion of white exposed in old photos. Perhaps the owners spoke only of gold, deposits so rich nuggets tumbled out of the mountainside right into a man's fist shirt or boots. Maybe they warned miners to hurry up the steep road to the last chance, pocket mine flowing with supine untold millions. But no one told how snow would envelop the porches, the windows, the tallest balconies, the Hotel Tedros street sign, the roof steeply pitched to resist it, even the church steeple, as if Cornucopia were draped in page after page of frigid calligraphy, as if the snow covering everything was some intimate handwritten letter the weather was slowly composing. I doubt anyone bothered to warn the miners about a winter hard-hearted enough to bury the nearby strawberry farm, or to divulge how the snow would slope from the roof and barricade the doorway to the saloon, to Brown and Pierce General Store. Surely no one spoke of the snow's ominous promises, its glints of blizzard and avalanche, its flash of slick ice in the dark, or about its spirit is packed with the wind, who agrees to design its witcheries so long as its drifts will sift to the rafters. Neither, I'm sure, did anyone inform the Cornish miners about winter's wry irony. They were forced to tunnel from their door into the cold morning and slave away in another man-made cave. Nor did anyone tell them, twirling their pale wives at Keller Dance Hall, how much they mirrored the storm outside, gliding by the window in swallowtails and gown, elegantly snowing.
One of the things that has always fascinated me since I've come to live in the Pacific Northwest, I've been here now a little over 21 years, and I came from the Great Lakes region, a completely different but equally astonishing geology, geography, and meteorology, for that matter. Yeah. We're talking weather here, folks. So one of the things that was really notable to me, which was not in my part of the Great Lakes region, was that there's all these mountain ranges, and they're all really different from each other. So there's this, you know, there are these mountains in eastern Oregon that are like the Alps.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's the volcanic range, of course, that gets all the press, so to speak. And the coast range, that ain't nothing, you know. So when you were reading, I thought, oh, he's got it. He's got, you know, one of our mountain sets in there with the snow.
Yeah.
That is, of course, part of the sort of what personality of the mountains.
Yeah, one thing I was trying to do with the book is link Eastern and Western Oregon quite a bit. So I hope that comes across because there, you know, I lived in out in Eastern Oregon for, oh, 3 or 4 years, taught at Eastern Oregon University, and it was a wonderful place. I met my wife out there. Wonderful place.
And amazing.
It's funny, here in Portland, a lot of folks say Eastern Oregon, they mean like Madras or something, but.
That's not really Eastern Oregon. Also, and this happens in every state where there's one big city and then the rest of the state, folks don't take into account, or actually don't have any knowledge of. It's not like they're being nasty about it. They literally don't know. There's this whole other set of worlds.
Very true.
And they're only really limited, if they're limited at all, by the lines that people have drawn on paper saying, okay, this is Oregon, as if you could say, okay, and that is Idaho. Well, yeah, but, you know, the land is the land. That's a whole nother thing. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that reading.
Most welcome.
Yeah, what a pleasure. Okay, one more time. This is KBOO, folks who have just tuned in. Now, you missed the reading. You'll have to come back and listen online. Luckily, you can, as long as the net lasts. You'll be able to listen anywhere, anytime to this show. So our guest tonight is Matt Schumacher. This is Poetry and Everything. So now we're in the question and answer part of the show. And here's the first thing I thought about when I thought about Q&A with you and your and thinking about your work. Though many people may think new fabulism is a term applicable only to prose fiction, which is what I sort of hear folks say, Phantom Drift, the magazine that you work with as a poetry editor, the website of Phantom Drift, which of course I looked at to do my homework for the show.
Well, thank you.
The website explains in its poetry guidelines that the editors want to publish work that, now I'm quoting here, shatters or valuably distorts reality.
That sounds like me, actually.
Well, clearly you wrote this then. Whether this means surrealism, magical realism, fantastique, or bizarrerie, end quote.
That's me.
And that you, quote, value writing whose imagination is unafraid to shift shape, writing that generates unique alternatives to and uncharted voyages away from conventional realism. So that's what y'all mean by new fabulism in your work and certainly in the magazine that you work with. How long have you been affiliated with Phantom Drift as a poetry editor or as anything for that matter?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've been around for 6 years now. This is our sixth issue that just came out, and lucky enough to capture a literary arts fellowship in 2015, which allowed us to continue. And I believe I'm slated to become managing editor next year, so I'm going to take on quite a bit of responsibility. I'm a little, my knees are shaking a bit. So
yeah. Less poetic, more business.
See what happens, yeah. I hope that I still get to exercise some choice about the work, but
You want a little lyricism in the job.
I took extra poetry this issue just because of that, right? So, there's
going out with a big bang.
A lot of poems in the new issue.
Well, cool. That's good to know.
Yeah, thanks for finding that, because I've been meaning, I'm going to have to write the manifesto now that I'm managing editor. So maybe early on, I wrote the intro to the current issue.
Well, I think this language is, first of all, it is actually a little lyrical, even though it's prose. And also, it's pretty clear in terms of this is what we're doing. This is what we want to do. This is the way we think about the work that interests us and so on. And one of the things that immediately struck me, because one of the questions I like to ask on this show is what folks think about the notion of poetry being autobiographical, which a lot of people believe. Now, in prose, people don't make that assumption. But with poetry, a lot of people think every poem is nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Every poem is autobiography. And clearly, perhaps more clearly than in many situations, the kind of stuff that you folks are talking about is going to give the lie to that. Is that an appropriate response? Say some words about that. Any way you want to go with it.
I think certainly, where the autobiography comes in, I think, is that, I have a lifetime appreciation for the weird and strange. Like I mentioned, my job, is a security guard in a toothbrush factory infested with bats. And so a lot of experiences like that have contributed to this appreciation. And I think, even a fantastic writer, a writer who traffics in bizarrery, can still have elements of their autobiography that creep in, it's just that they allow more their horses to imagination to ride out into the sunset, right? So, I think that, to varying degrees, too, the work in the magazine will be autobiographical as well. So I like to think of, I think the fantastic has a revolutionary potential somewhere in it. Rosemary Jackson, I think, wrote the same thing. You think about Soviet realism and some of the authors that were writing during that time, writing fantastic work. They could have been executed. I mean, the state kind of knew that.
And indeed, some of them were.
Some of the writing therein certainly was exploring realms that the state found dangerous. So
I was reading something naturally, of course, I can't think of where or what, unfortunately. Sorry, I can't give you the footnotes, folks. I was reading something just in the last 24 hours about how poets have often been recognized immediately by oppressive governments as enemies of the state. That poetry somehow makes them crazy with fear.
Right.
Poets are dangerous. And it's so outrageous, particularly in the United States, where poets are often thought to be like, oh, please, by a lot of folks. I mean, needless to say, I don't agree with that. I'm a poetry writer my own self. But it's kind of ironic.
It is. Yeah. I mean, you think of a Mary Baraka just a few years ago, losing the laureateship for the poem that he wrote about. 9-1-1, right? So I think the potential.
That's a great example.
There. Yeah.
Very current.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Relatedly, but not I hope exactly the same thing. When you're thinking about form, or if you are thinking about form when you're beginning to write, talk with us a bit about how you choose or find could be one, could be the other, could be both, I guess, a form for a specific poem as you're working. What are your thoughts about such choices or such happenstance, the miracle of finding it? What do you think, in terms of form particularly?
Well, I think, yeah, I probably, you know, I might start off with the form and break away from it, or I might find my way to it. I think it could work either way.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I can think of a few poems. The one form that seems to work with my own oeuvre would be the Abecedarius, which, you know, there's a poem in the Drinking Songs that's an inverted one. So it starts with the Z, the first line zeroing in on the ouzo. So, I mean, and it works perfectly because that was a discovery later on, right? And
uh-huh.
But I had this idea, like, you know, the police sometimes want you to say the ABCs backwards. So it fit the occasion, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, form can add that particular layer that uh-huh. that makes a poem, just pushes a poem over the top.
Uh-huh.
I have a project. I didn't read any poems from it, but they're poems about spiders. And so my notion is to have, at first I wanted a computer program. You know, it's fairly simple to model an orb web with a computer program. They simulate it. They do this at Oxford University to study spider webs, but also, you know, what sort of the way I'm coming at it now is I want a series of poems that are shaped
like
orb
webs.
Yeah, orb webs, which one of the most beautiful structures out there, in my opinion.
Oh, and amazing. Particularly, of course, with drops of water on it.
Exactly.
Dew or rain, whatever. Yeah.
If I could do that, that would be a poem, huh?
Yeah, get to that, Matt, will you? Work on that.
Yeah.
Not only the web form, but give us those crystalline drops of water. We'll wait. No rush. I think a lot about the tremendous diversity of form that we see and hear now, including rap and slam and then visual stuff. You mentioned the online research and work, erasure and excision.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff, which is in no way, in my view anyway, in no way competitive with the classic forms, the sonnet at all, but an amazing addition too. You know, it's this like adding stuff to your library kind of thing, or to your toolkit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So do you find yourself, metabolizing all this new stuff or just checking it out? Or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you mean that was the program is basically experimental poetics. So I was exposed to some pretty far out there stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know. Christian Book came and read, and he's the sound poet, Canadian sound poet.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And he uses the methods of Ulipo, right? So lots of, you know, vocalic stuff, like in his one of his books, he limits himself just to the one vowel for a chapter. So it's in chapter E.
Wow.
Made these exhaustive word lists for, you know, 8 years, I think it was. The book's called Eunoia. That was a discovery for me. A sort of like form based on the vowels themselves. And his latest project, I don't know if you've heard about it, but it's he's worked with a geneticist, and he is encoding in a super bacteria. He's got this poem that he's turned into a cipher for the nucleic acids. So he calls it the Xenotex Project. So he's going to have a living poem in the DNA of the bacterium, which will outlive humanity, right?
Uh-huh.
If the whole place, you know, we're wiped away.
In the apocalypse, this poem will remain.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a mutation, of course, will change the poem too, right?
So yeah.
It's exciting stuff.
It is exciting. It's fascinating. I mean, even if any one of us doesn't particularly want to do that, it's super cool to think about it. Think about somebody applying a sensibility that includes research respect for and interest in form as part of the art of poetry, and doing it in this extraordinary, possibly semi-insane, but incredibly fascinating way. Yeah. And I always think, I go back to, I've probably said this on other shows, people think, oh, this is so new, this is so new. And then I think about my, you know, the two 19th century American crazy geniuses, Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. Now, those were people who fooled around with form in ways that, and not like each other either, not like anybody else and not like each other. And so it's not like, oh, wow, in the 21st century, everything's just falling apart. Well, no, people have been attempting to make art with words in this, in these various ways for an awfully long time.
Yeah, two things about Dickinson. I remember learning, can sing all of her poems to the Yellow Rose of Texas, that rhythm. So try it sometime. It works.
I'm going to believe you. We're not going to do it right now on the show, folks, but you can do it. You can try this at home.
Also, you know, the fascicles, she sewed her poems. So
yes.
I remember learning this in Ed Folsom's class at Iowa, but the dashes, you know, which are pretty signature, apparently they're in the fascicles, which, you know, sewed works, they're oriented at angles, and they think that that might have had to do with how she wanted the poem to be read, right? Inflection up or down, or pretty cool stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't think I know about that part.
Yeah.
Well, she was an incredibly complex and fascinating mind and spirit, and we're lucky to have all the stuff that we do have from long ago.
I love those two poets.
Excuse me. Okay, another question, a sort of classic interview the poet type question. What poets and or poems have been not just favorites, but useful to you, important to you in terms of the craft and your own work? Can you tell us?
Sure, I guess, something when I teach a poetry class, something I drop on the students fairly early in terms of the line. There's an old adage from Yehuda Amichai, the Israeli poet, a pot on each shelf, right? So each, you know, if you think of the lines as shelves, each of them should have something redeeming within the line. And I've always loved that.
So that's, it's a wonderful image. I'm already seeing shelves of pots as you're talking.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want those to be throwaway. So, I mean, it's a good way for a young poet to think about their lines too, right? Mm-hmm. Something about the line needs to be there to keep it. So
if you're gonna keep it, or when you're looking at your own work, if you don't find that, the ability to say, you know what, this is gonna go. Really tough.
That's huge. I know, especially if you like it for some cockamamie reason, right?
Exactly. Well, sometimes the only reason is I made this. I love it. But, you know, that's not really a good enough reason. I mean, it's a good enough reason to maybe keep it on a shelf in the back, but not necessarily bring it forward.
Well, you mentioned Dickinson, too. I mean, her definition of a poem is always, a real poem should make you feel like your head's been taken off. You know, that one I've always prescribed to that. I think that's, the Juhasz poem I read, I think that's the case. I mean, I should feel like something's happened to you, something fairly momentous. And
that you literally feel in your body, the way Dickinson said.
Yeah, a visceral sort of experience, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah, I'm for that. In fact, I was looking for poems for another one of our shows, for one of the ones that's going to happen in 2017, and I pulled out a collection by Belle Waring that I hadn't read for years. I think it might have even been her first book. And I started to read it, and I read the first poem, and I thought, whoa! Because I had that response, that bodily thing. I thought, well, I guess I better reread this collection.
Yeah, this has never happened to me before, feeling, right? Yeah, I love that. Wow.
And this is even a book I did read before, but it happened again.
Happened
again inside of my body when
it's
I was reading.
It's amazing how some poems have that power.
Yeah. So I'm, already awash in gratitude to her, even though I've just read the first poem on the second time around. Okay, now another of the classic interview the poet questions that's particularly relevant right now, and that's asking you about your thoughts about the concept of poetry having political value or purpose.
Yeah.
As you know, in the United States for quite some time, not necessarily from the beginning of the Republic, as we have liked to call it, but for quite some time, it's been unacceptable in many quarters to be overtly political. Whereas in every other country in the world, people say, well, yeah, this is like what our lives are made of. Naturally, we're going to write about it.
Yeah.
So what have you thought about this? Clearly you have. I can see, I'm telling you folks, I'm sitting here in the studio. I can see on his face. He's thought
the
about this.
The wheels have been turning.
Yes.
Well, especially of late, right?
Yeah. Well, exactly. That's why I thought, oh, I have to ask this one. Yeah.
Well, you know, if artists don't respond, who will, right? I mean, I think it's partially our responsibility in some quarters to build something. Yeah, I'm right there with George Orwell, who believes that the four great motives of writing include a social motive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, in the essay Why I Write, I agree 100% with him. You know, I think that he says that it made him the memorable writer that he was, that motive, mm-hmm. even though his impulse was to write like long-winded novels with purple passages and that sort of thing. So, mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. Social motive. Yeah. And also that historical motive to get the facts right. I think that's another motive that a poem certainly could illustrate, right?
Yeah. And also, of course, they cross. I mean, I'm thinking right away of your first person, Mr. White, that you read to us.
Yeah.
That is not an apolitical poem,
no.
even though it is a persona
yeah.
poem and so on and so forth. It's clearly about what was going on, politically speaking, sociopolitically in his time.
Yeah, the Ghost Town Odes have, I think, quite a few. There's a Vanport poem in here in the voice of a drowning victim.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of poems in the book that I think take on a political stance. So,
mm-hmm.
And it's a good time to do it, right?
It is, yeah. It's a good reminder, prompt, and particularly, as you said, of the necessity. It's not just, oh, well, maybe we'll do this.
Well, I also think of the Wobblies, right, and Joe Hill and those, mm-hmm. those great poets, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, Cary Nelson at University of Illinois, he has books about protest poetry and
yeah.
Gosh, great,
I haven't thought
books.
About Cary Nelson for quite a while, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
A serious scholar of this in this arena.
Yeah, I think he would be a good place to go to if you wanted some encyclopedic knowledge about the history of protest poetry.
Yeah, definitely. Good prompt. Thank you. Okay, another one. It's a little different. It's something that interests me personally. Do you memorize your work?
Sometimes.
Uh-huh.
I do. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't get around to it. But I do find that, obviously, like the memorized ones become a lot more animated and you can, right? You think about ways to perform them.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you know, I do have a handful of poems like that. So,
yeah. And so you don't memorize them simply because you read them a lot and they come into you, but you say, I'm going to memorize this one.
Yeah. It just sometimes the poem's language means enough to me that I carry forward with it, or it's just easy to remember,
uh-huh.
right? That's how rhyme was created, as I recall.
Absolutely.
As a mnemonic, so I mean,
right.
Yeah, so
long ago and far away,
yeah.
And maybe not so far away, actually, but certainly long, long ago, they said it.
Yeah.
They said and sang it.
Yeah.
The bards.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they knew all of it. I mean, can you imagine knowing the Iliad?
Oh, I know. It's amazing. Yeah.
And or any of that stuff.
Each night it would be different somehow, too,
oh,
right?
Of
because
course.
They're so good at
just like in the theater. If you were to see a play three nights in a row, you can be sure it would not be exactly the same each time because that's not how humanity or any living organism operates. Yeah, right. Okay, last. Or maybe not the last, but near the end, formal question. What are you reading now? And why did you choose it? And what do you think of it?
Oh, poetry-wise?
Anything.
Oh, okay. Well, I belong to a poetry group with several other local poets. And we just read Ada Limón's Bright Dead Things. Great book.
Uh-huh.
Fantastic book. But let's see. Oh, I just got Ed Sanders' book, Fug You, about the fugs.
Oh, the fugs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and about the fugs, like the fish with a pH, a band. Yeah, go ahead.
It's kind of a strange thing. I was watching, I like to, you know, cipher through YouTube videos. So I just caught an old episode of The Firing Line with him and Jack Kerouac. And I want to say, there are a couple other characters in the mix too, but it's great to watch. And Sanders is brilliant on that episode. So I figured I should pick that up. And also purchased a book about Athanasius Kircher, the medieval practitioner of universal knowledge.
This one I don't know.
Just a sort of bizarre cat who he made all these inventions. He had like sundials in the shape of animals and things like this. He lowered himself into Vesuvius to see what it was like down there, and wrote these crazy beautiful books.
He did that.
Yeah.
Literally.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking. Well, people actually have done that not that long ago at Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
For the obvious reasons. So why should I be surprised?
Well, yeah. I suppose he was a man of the cloth, for one thing. And I think that the more you read about him, the more you would be surprised. I think a genius. And looking at his books, I mean, they're sort of wonder cabinets, I guess you'd say. So I'm fascinated by them. Had this frontispiece in the front of each one of them with this elaborate illustration. I can't reproduce it here, obviously, but
yeah, of course, right.
But yeah, check it out. He's a cool cat.
Everybody listening, and me too, we'll check it out. we'll do that homework. Absolutely. Okay, I'm gonna ask you this because we have a few more minutes. I found this little riff from Wanda Coleman.
Oh yeah, I like her.
Yeah. Some good stuff. We're grateful to her. And she was talking about teaching, which you have mentioned a few times also. So that's why I thought, I'll stick this one in at the end. She said, "When I'm teaching, first we do an idea as a poem. Then we do it as a short story. Then we do it as a screenplay. Then we do it as a play. Then we do it as an essay. And it just blows their minds. I show them how you take the same material, but it's how you use it. You can go from structure to structure using the same material or the same idea." So, any comments at all about this? First of all, I loved her for saying this.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a longtime teacher myself, I thought, whoa, that is so, I wish I thought of that.
Yeah.
Have you ever done anything like that in the classroom? Have you ever done anything like that in your own practice? What do you think?
I love the idea. You know, I don't think I have. I don't think I've pushed and seen how malleable one idea was. That must be fascinating to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to see how it could possibly work in those various genres.
She makes me want to do it.
Yeah, I would love to try that. Well, we should do that, both of us.
Yes.
Yeah,
that will be our
homework. Show each
other
work. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's a great prompt, actually.
I think it's completely brilliant. And I thought, well, why didn't I know this? Why didn't I think of this? Maybe she didn't say it then when I was a classroom teacher. But what you just said is very interesting. We should just do it ourselves. It's not about what we tell the students.
I have a prompt. I give my poetry students this. It's usually the first, two prompts, actually. Poem with the title of a weekly world news headline. Which is pretty good, usually. Like Old West Town Discovered on Venus or something. I wrote that one. And then write in the voice of an animal, which stole from my old teacher, Linda Gregg. So, yeah, but it's, you know, it makes you think, what animal and what would that sound like if it began to speak? And
well, right away, I think of your cat, the cat poem you read to us, and the one about the foal. Yeah. I mean, not your own, obviously, but still, if we're writing about animals, we obviously must be animals that are other than human animals, we must be, attempting to channel them in some way to meld our consciousness with theirs or something. Maybe that sounds a little high flown, but you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And so whether we're going to speak as the animal in the poem or not, we have to do some of that if we're going to cross species.
Right.
Although, turns out we have enough trouble crossing gender, age.
Very true.
Et cetera. Species might be way beyond our reach, but I don't know, maybe that would be good practice for being able to do it human to human. I just thought of that. I like that idea.
I like it too. I like that a lot, actually.
That's homework for that. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah. So thank you for listening, folks. And remember, support your local independent bookstores, your independent reading series, and of course, your independent community radio. Good night.
Wait a minute. Where do you think you're going? This is KBOO Portland. It's time for the Sudden Radio Project.
You were in charge of bringing the lattes.
I can't believe this. You did. I mean, it's not me. It was him. You were supposed to bring the latte.
Don't we have interns? I mean, if we had interns, at least we could send them out for interns. And, you know, next time I'll never get a change. But you never get your change. The coffee just was important. Hey, wait a minute. Are we in there?
I'd say so.
What is this?
Who hired her?
She's a volunteer.
Who hired her?
You're a volunteer, too.
I can't work under these conditions.